here we go. So what I want to do this evening, if you saw that the sources are structured on one really wildly cool tshuva of Rabbi Ezekiel Landau, the Noda Behuda, who is a late 18th century figure, that's going to matter, living in various parts across Europe, and one of the most politically aware rabbis in Europe. We're going to do four things about his responsa, which you can have a cool acronym, it's SCCL. We're going to do structure, content, context, and legacy. Okay, so I want to start by making some points about the structure of his responsa, and then we'll go on to the specific content of it, and then we'll talk about the historical context, and then we'll talk about legacy. So here's the thing about the structure. So as far as you got in Chavruta,
are we recording the video?
Yep.
So you'll probably see that what happens at the outset of the responsum is we're sort of really dealing with a nested letter. There were two rabbis in London who were asked the question about whether you could autopsy bodies after death in order to gain medical knowledge. One of the rabbis said yes, and he quoted two sources in favor. One of the rabbis said no, and he quoted a source against. The rabbi who quoted, who said in favor, said something about the source the rabbi said against. They went to Rabbi Leib Fischel's, it was Rabbi Landau's son-in-law, and he said that all of their proofs were wrong. Right? All of them were wrong. But he had his own proof. And he brought his own proof, which is really very cool. And then they go to Rabbi Landau, and Rabbi Landau says that all of your proofs are wrong. Okay, so these are with various degrees of cleverness. The simple proofs that were brought originally in favor were a claim that we had, first of all, simply that mummification seems to be permitted in the Torah. Our forefathers are mummified. Yaakov is mummified. Joseph is mummified. Mummification involves cutting into the body and taking out all the internal organs. So how can you claim that it's forbidden to cut the body up if mummification is permitted? There's a second case where, in order to rebury, there was a father who had, the children were planning to bury him in an ancestral plot. The ancestral plot was across an artificial political boundary in Europe. There was a war. You don't get to, they couldn't bury him in his ancestral plot, so they buried him temporarily where he was. And then there was a break in the war, and they wanted to rush and bury him across. But the problem is the body was partially decomposed. Partially decomposed bodies are not fun to transport. So they wanted to pour a caustic substance into the grave in order to melt away all the flesh so it would just turn into bones, collect the bones, and transport the body, and that was also permitted. So in each of those cases, it sounds like we don't really break, we can do all sorts of things to the body after that, and no one cares. The response to that is, no, that's no proof at all, because you're doing those things for the honor of the body, not for something external. Right? You want the body to look better, that's mummification. You want you want the body to be transported in a dignified fashion. You want it to be buried where it wants to be buried. So that's not a proof about randomly autopsying people who happen to die of diseases that interest you in a hospital. It doesn't prove anything, although later people will try to claim that gaining medical knowledge is actually also for the honor of the dead, and you can decide whether that argument is compelling or not. The argument in favor is that there's a Gemara of Bava Basra that says that under a certain circumstance where people wanted to exhume a body to prove that the body had not reached puberty, so that a sale that had been conducted whose body is now dead, was invalid because the person had not reached adulthood. So they wanted to exhume the body to prove that he had not reached puberty, and that was turned down. You weren't allowed to do it, so that was taken as a proof that you can't mar the body after death, and that was rejected very simply by saying, okay, you can't mar the dead for money. That has nothing to do with our case. We're dealing with trying to gain medical knowledge. So that's rejected. The cleverest proof is brought by the officials himself. The official says that the Talmud raises a hypothetical possibility that we should require autopsies in all cases of murder because of the possibility that the victim was actually halakhically considered a trefa. We talked about that last week. Somebody who is halakhically a little bit dead, so that killing them is not a capital crime. It's still very, very wrong, but it's not a capital crime. And so whenever there's a murder, we should have to examine the victim to see if the victim is a trefa, or we said to say whether find out whether the victim is glatt kosher. The victim is not glatt kosher, then you can't execute them because they have a puncture. They might have a puncture in their lung. So the interesting thing there is, so he says, look, the Talmud suggests, and in principle believes that it should be true, except that for, that should be true that we should be allowed to autopsy the victim in order to prevent ourselves from executing the murderer. That's about as little for the honor of the dead as you can imagine, and yet it's okay. So that's a really clever proof. Rabbi Fishel gets the A-minus on the course. But Rabbi Lando comes up with an even cleverer disproof. Rabbi Lando says, no, you don't really understand. If we allow the autopsy, what that really means is that we won't allow anyone to be executed until we have an autopsy. So while the autopsy is being conducted in order to spare this particular murder, the principle of autopsies is being conducted in order to allow the execution of any murderer. And therefore, he says, really the purpose of the autopsies in such cases would be to enable the punishment of murderers, which is in fact for the honor of the victim. And that proof is gone as well. It's really, it has several other layers of circularity, but it's really very clever. But here's my structural point. So now, Rolando's gotten rid of everybody's proof, and now what does he do? He cites absolutely no evidence. At this point, right, he says that he has disposed of all precedent, and he deals with the question from scratch. And that's a really cool move to make in a tshuva, but you'll often find it then in responsa, that the first thing you do is play defense, and make sure that there's absolutely no dispositive evidence, and if there is any, you try to dispose of the dispositive evidence, and then you address the question from scratch. And that's what Rabbi Lando does here. He says, right, he says that we've gotten rid of all the precedents. Nothing that you said specifically about the issue of marring the dead is legally relevant to our case. But then he asks, he says, you're really asking the wrong question. The question you've been asking is it permitted to mar the dead for medical purposes? Really, there's only two ways to answer the question. Are medical purposes considered to be life-saving? If yes, then obviously you're allowed to mar the dead because you can do anything to save. Right? You can do just about anything to save lives. Where would we get this idea that you can't mar a dead body to save lives? Somebody suggests that later. The Binyan Siyam makes the attempt to claim it, but it's really, really wild. So Rabbi Lando is really compelling on that survey. He says, I don't understand what you guys are arguing about. If this is considered life-saving, then it's permitted. If it's not considered life-saving, then nobody thinks you can mar the dead just for fun. So why would it be permitted here? Right, so the whole issue is completely reframed. He's gotten rid of all prior evidence, and he has framed the issue starkly and in completely new terms. And the issue is, what do we do about that? Is it life-saving or is it not life-saving? So now, if you turn to page 6 and 7.
We don't know ahead of time.
That's okay. So we don't know ahead of time. So we have another rule. What the rule is, that any possibility of life-saving justifies violating just about all law. Right? If somebody is under a building on Shabbat, and you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of saving them by violating every prohibition on Shabbat in order to get them out, the fact that it's a 1 in 1,000 chance doesn't bother us at all. For the purposes of halakha, generally, our rule is that safek pikuach nefesh, right, a possibility of nefesh, functions exactly the same as vadai pikuach nefesh. Okay, they're possible, but if we were having intellectual fun, maybe that's not true with fetuses, maybe it's not true if you're trying to resurrect somebody who's already dead. Right, there's some fun ways around it, but as a matter of normal practice, we don't distinguish at all. And since we don't distinguish at all, so as long as there's a chance that cutting up this body is going to lead to some kind of medical knowledge that is going to lead to some patient being saved, everything should be great. So what's the question? So we take a look at line 90. So we'll watch as how Rabbi Lando puts this together. He says, but I am astonished. If this is called even a doubt of saving life, why do you need all this elaborate argumentation? It is clear and explicit law that even a doubt pushes aside all the strict rules of Shabbat. The explicit Mishnah on Yom Kippur 3 states that all doubts with regard to life push aside Shabbat. And there it says not only a doubt regarding this Shabbat, but even a doubt regarding some future Shabbat. There are no limits, right? Really, in principle, there are no limits to life-saving. And so if you believe that this is life-saving, then there should be no issue at all, and autopsy should be absolutely permitted. Okay, let's run with it. Let's say it's permitted. He's not willing to run with it. Here's what he says. Rather, all this is, and he, right, and he comes up with, with an important term in line 96. Kol ze biyesh safek sakanat nefashot lifaneinu. All this is when the danger to life is in before us, is in our presence. And all the previous cases discussed cases where the person who might be saved is in your is before you in your presence, presenting themselves to you. Whereas he says, in our case, there is no sick person who needs who directly benefits from the operation. Rather, right on line 101, they seek to gain the skill as perhaps a sick person will present who needs this. Right? You're doing this because there might be another patient. And he says, if you're just talking about that, and certainly, here he goes all the way, because of this slight concern, do not push aside any biblical prohibition or even a rabbinic prohibition. Right? So he says, so he comes up with a totally new standard. The new standard, the word comes up is chole lifaneinu, a sick or sakanat nefashot lifaneinu, danger to life or a sick person presenting in front of us. And if there is a sick person in front of us, if there's a million to one chance, you do it. And if you're talking about hypothetical knowledge gain, which might benefit a future patient, then you can't violate anything. Okay, that's his new, totally bright line, for which he presents absolutely no evidence in halakhic precedent. If we were to say, not subtly, we would say he made it up. Why did he make it up? So he tells you. He says, because if you call this kind of situation, gaining medical knowledge, to be doubt regarding life, then all medical work, including the grinding and cooking of ingredients and the preparation of the piercing tool for bloodletting, would be permitted on Shabbat on the chance that today or tonight a sick person will present needing that medicine. So all pharmaceutical companies can function 24/7. All medical research companies can function 24/7. If you say that the possibility of getting knowledge, right, all university biology departments can function 24/7. If you believe that the gaining knowledge that might have medical consequences is pikuach nefesh, then basically you've opened yourself up to having society basically eliminated, for large elements of society would function the way doctors do in our world with beepers. Right? Where, for certain purposes, right? But that's, at least doctors can only have beepers, right? All cancer researchers would be required to go to work every day. We can have other questions, right? Why are they ever allowed to take vacations? So the whole, all society would stop. He says there has to be a line somewhere. So he creates a line. And the line is the sick person has to be in front of us. But he has a second issue. It's not just the issue that he thinks that this will destroy Shabbat for large, right? And for all sorts of other things, it also comes up in terms of what prohibitions you can violate to go to medical school, all sorts of issues like that. And he says, heaven forfend that we permit this. Even the Gentile doctors do not experiment in the field of surgery on any cadaver, other than those executed by the courts or those who agreed to such in their lifetime. The idea that you can cut up somebody who didn't consent in advance and wasn't executed, then right, nobody thinks you can do that. It's against the ethical conscience of the world. So are we going to have halakha be more lenient than the ethical conscience of the world? And then he tells you what's going to happen if halakha does this. If God forbid we would be lenient in this matter, then all the dead will be cut in order so as to learn the arrangement and nature of internal organs, so they will know how to heal the living. Therefore, extensive discussion is unnecessary, and there is no ground for permission. And you, Rabbi Fishel, as my beloved son-in-law, you rushed into this and you didn't think about the implications. Okay. So we started off structurally, he got rid of all the evidence, and made this a totally new situation, which could be dealt with rationally, as opposed to textually. Yes, sir?
I have one question here. When you brought in the comparison with the external world and what they do and how
yes.
We don't want to... I thought that, in general, people who passed in were always claiming that they were not influenced at all by idea.
So that's part of why this is a fascinating tshuva, right? As opposed to arguing that he's dealing entirely from internal values, he gets rid of all the internal evidence, invents a standard, and locates that, right, and justifies that standard on the basis of a slippery slope argument, an appeal to the conscience of the world, and a consequent, right, and then a specific consequential argument, we're going to end up cutting everybody. So where did this all come from? So there is a biography by Wendy Moore called Knife Man, The Life and Times of John Hunter, Surgical Pioneer, in which you discover something about the context of this response, which you recall is written to London. So this book was recommended to me by Rabbi Yitzchak Blau some years ago, and I read it, and I said, oh my goodness, that's what's going on in the Dodi Biuda. So here we are. We're in the late 18th century, and in France, a doctor whose name I forget, developed, right, is starting to do genuine medical research by dissecting cadavers, the few cadavers he gets, which are either people that whose bodies he buys before death, or that are given to him because they're executed by the crown. In the process of this, he develops an improved method of bladder stone surgery. That method appeals greatly to a man in London named John Hunter, and here we are at the question being asked to Rabbi lay officials in London. Dr. John Fisher decides that this is the way in which all medical surgery should happen in the future, that really, if we could just do cadaver surgery and practice, then all our surgical techniques would be improved. And he develops this radical idea that the way to train doctors is anatomy lab. And so he sets up a medical school, which has, for the first time, actual live cadavers. It was not live, right? Fresh cadavers. Sorry, that was zombies. That was last week. Fresh cadavers that students can dissect. So they can, right? And he comes up with all sorts of improvements in surgery. But remember, at the very beginning, it's the improvements in the mode of bladder stone surgery, exactly what we're talking about. Here's the problem. They don't have refrigeration. If you want to run a medical school with people having fresh cadavers, you need a lot of cadavers. And while England was, you know, fairly notorious for having high crime rates and high execution rates, you just can't get enough by just taking executed prisoners. And besides, some of the executed prisoners don't want to have it handled that way. So John Hunter sets off an incredible wave of grave robbing. Where he hires gangs, and the gangs. First of all, you have these wonderful scenes where the person is being hung and they're swinging, and the relatives are on one side and John Hunter's goons are on the other side, and they're each trying desperately to get the body down. Right, the relatives want to bury it and the goons want to grab it. You have graves that, as Hunter gets competition, there are competing gangs of grave robbers going through, and sometimes if you get there like an hour after sunset, all the graves in the churchyard are empty. Because all the bodies have already been taken. So it turns out there's one crazy story. Hunter has this dream of supporting his family eventually by creating a museum, which actually did eventually exist, and if the collection still exists, of anatomical oddities. And so his big thing is going to be there's this 8-foot man who he thinks that when that person dies, he's going to get their body and he's going to display their skeleton, and that's going to be the big money winner for his museum. The only problem is that this guy is a frum Christian, and he does not want to be autopsied after death. He wants to be buried. So he makes, and he knows that Hunter tried to buy his body in his lifetime. He knows that Hunter's going after him. So he makes sure with his friends that Hunter is not going to get his body. He begs his friends, you have to make sure as soon as I die, you have to put me in the coffin and carry me out to sea and bury my body at sea so Hunter can't get past me. So he's buried, right, he dies, and he's put in his coffin, and his friends lift this heavy man's coffin, and they're walking off towards the sea with his body, sure that he has escaped the clutches of John Hunter, but it's a long walk, and it's hot, and they're thirsty. And they stop, and a friendly innkeeper comes out and offers them a drink. They put the coffin down. When they pick it up, it weighs the same amount, and they go off to the sea, but meanwhile, poor buddy is on his way to John Hunter. John Hunter, where it is boiled down and turned into a skeleton, and it actually is what Hunter leaves to his wife and kids as the basis of the collection that he thinks will support them when he dies young, as he expects to. So, the reality that Odebuta is facing is that, in fact, he recognizes fully, he's not unaware of the advantages to medical knowledge of autopsies. But he's also entirely right that if he permits autopsies for medical knowledge, then everybody will be dissected. And more specifically, if a Jew permits the autopsying of bodies for the sake of medical knowledge, then since the Christians don't allow it, every Jewish body in Europe will be dissected for the sake of medical knowledge. And so he's trying to find a way in which, on the one hand, he can honor what he thinks is a real value, pikuach nefesh, we like saving lives, and on the other hand, a real risk, which is that we are going to completely eliminate the notion of kavod hamet. Every Jewish body is going to be autopsied, and Hunter's autopsies weren't gentle. So in order to resolve that, he came up with a brand new standard. And the standard was cholel lefaneinu, that if there is a patient specifically that you want to practice because you have this patient in front of you, so then we're going to hold up the value of pikuach nefesh. But we're not going to say just for the sake of knowledge, because that has socially unsustainable consequences in a variety of ways. And that's really, although there were competing positions to Noda Bihuna, there was the Binyan Sion and the Chassam Sofer, but in terms of the dominant intellectual force, the Noda Bihuna really is what dominates halakha for 100 years. At some point, somebody gets the idea that the issue is that that if a piece of your body is missing, then you won't get resurrected, or you won't get resurrected properly. I don't know how this makes it into popular discourse. It has no weight in halachic discourse except for people saying, I've heard other people saying this ridiculous idea, and I wish to reject it. Yet it shows up. It shows up all over the place in astonishing ways. And, you know, this, Rav Sandigon already dealt with the question of what happens if you're eaten by a lion, and the matter gets transported to another, you know, it makes it to another person. You know what? God can resurrect people eaten by lions, and if you're autopsied, God can find a way to put your body back together again. So it's not a serious halachic concern. What is halachic concern is the Noda Bihuda standard. So the question is, how does that relate to, right? So we talked about about the structure of the tshuva, which is to get rid of the evidence and address the issue from scratch. The content, which is to develop this new standard called cholel lefaneinu. The context, which is that he's dealing with a very specific historical phenomenon where the consequences of being lenient would be, in fact, universal autopsies, which, by the way, still exist in certain contexts. For example, the United States Army. All deaths in the United States Army as of some years ago were subject to autopsy. And the ground for that was that you learned enormous things, especially deaths in Iraq, which is how you learned about explosives. And that's how they developed all sorts of improved shielding for armored vehicles and things like that. But it went to, it became various court cases because Muslims specifically protested against having their bodies autopsied. So then the army made it a requirement for enlistment that you have to sign a consent form for autopsies. And the question was that religious discrimination against people who only allow autopsies in narrow circumstances, as opposed to army policy, which is that every death is presumptively autopsied for medical knowledge. So it's not an Noda Bihuda's concern is not an ancient concern. It's a live concern. So what happens? So I wanted to show you as part of what happens. Two pieces from Rav Chil Yaakov Weinberg. This is page 89. I apologize for the typo. The zeros on page 8 in English. That's a typo. Rav Chil Yaakov Weinberg was one of the great figures he was an Eastern European figure who became one of the great figures of Western Europe before World War II. He was the head of Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin, even though he was an Eastern European. After the war, he sort of retired to Switzerland because he kept getting trapped in battles between left and right wings, between Eastern and Western Europeans, and he decided he was better off staying in Switzerland out of this. In Dr. Mark Shapiro's biography of him, the opening scene is Rechel Weinberg is being marched by his academic friends to one burial, his Zionist friends to one burial, and a group of Haredim come in and steal the body and march him off and bury him somewhere else. So he's a figure exactly right to talk about this kind of issue. So when I read his response about Kol Sridei Hesh, the leftovers from the flame, and when I read Dr. Shapiro's biography, I said, you know, it's a fine biography, but I didn't understand, reading the biography, why Rabbi Weinberg was so great. Like, what justified his reputation? So Dr. Shapiro gave the best answer possible. He said, well, I put out two books of his other writings. Read those books and you'll understand why. And he sent me a copy of the books, which is very generous of him, and I read through the books. And in fact, when you read through the separate writings of Rabbi Weinberg, you understand why he's great in a way you might not from the response and from the biography. And I want to show you how that plays out here. So if you look at the first thing on page 8, is a response of Rabbi Weinberg addressing this issue of what happens. He says, to my dear friend Dr. Wislitsky, head of the hospital in Manchester, regarding your question about dissecting the dead for the purpose of healings, he gives you a list of sources. And he says, in summary, the Noda Behuda says that it's permitted for the sake of life-saving, but only when there is a patient before us that we can thereby save. There's a dispute between Maram Shik, sorry for that type also, and the Binyan Sion, about whether consent is sufficient or not. And really, there are two prohibitions, Nivul Hamet, marring the dead, and benefit from the dead. And that's his whole response to them. Okay, all of you could have said that now. Didn't need Rabbi Weinberg to say that. Doesn't address anything about changes in medical practice, modernity, anything like that. It's just, it's a pretty... doctor asked a question, he cited literature. Okay. But in the writings of Rabbi Weinberg, there's a letter to Rabbi Kalman Kahana, which you can figure out is dated somewhere in the late 1940s, early 50s. And here's what he says there. In my opinion, the situation in our generation is different than it was in the time of the Noda Behuda, both in regard to the prevailing attitude in the medical world and in regard to the relationship of doctors to the question of dissecting the dead, a total change. The Gaon Noda Behuda in his time thought that life-saving meant in a place where a severely ill patient is lying before us and there's a possibility to save him by examining the illness of the dead body before us. But guess what? We have universal communication now. It makes no sense to talk about a dead body in our physical presence as a standard for life-saving, because if there's a patient anywhere in the world, they can benefit from this information immediately. So a dead person, a patient before us, there's always a patient before us, unless it's a rare disease. So that's his first argument. He says that, right, he says that Noda Behuda is obsolete because instantaneous communication means that any patient anywhere in the world is lifanei. Then he makes a second argument. He says, there's a need to emphasize that in our time, the question of dissecting the dead is a question of the state and the question of the people living in the state. Noda Behuda dealt with a private question, and therefore he was correct. But in our time, it is a national question and a question of the state of its standing in the greater world, which pays great heed to everything that occurs in the land with attentive ears. Everyone knows that a civilized world is really important for Israel's survival, and so what people think of us is an issue of national security. And not only that, you can't have a state without medical schools, and nobody thinks that you could have medical schools now without anatomy labs. So the question of what the Jews as a minority should do in the culture of Europe in terms of dissection is an entirely different question than the question of what you should do in a state where you have to build the medical professions. It says, right, it's impossible to consider that it is possible to satisfy this need via gentle doctors or doctors who are trained in the diaspora. Even a crazy or mindless person would not say that the state of Israel has to build its medicine by only having Gentile doctors be trained or by sending all the doctors abroad. So there has to be dissection in Israeli medical schools. And he says, when doctors ask me the question privately, I was often lenient, and he sends you to the response that we read. But today, when the question relates to the Jewish people in the state of Israel, I cannot forbid, as it is clear to me, that the prohibition would lead to the separation of the state from the religion, which he doesn't see as a good thing. Right, not separation of church and state in the sense that the religion doesn't control the state, but the state would deliberately set itself up in opposition to the religion. And the Jewish doctor studying this wisdom university in Lahidas, I have expressed my opinion to your honor with an open heart, and will not hide from your honor that if the matter were up to me, I would permit the universities to dissect those who die of illnesses when the diagnosis is in doubt or complex, But now I do not wish to issue a formal ruling and can use this letter of mine as your wisdom dictates. So there's a lot to talk about in Rabbi Weinberg, but there always is because there are so many qualifiers and fears of politics at the end here that it's difficult to deal with sometimes. But you can see a framing that takes a great deal of intellect, courage, and perception. That the issue is, right, he says, the issue is just a different question when you're dealing in the 18th century and you have the possibility of limiting knowledge geographically, and when you're dealing with a case where you're just a minority in a different culture and a case where you have the responsibility for the development of the whole culture. And he ends up saying that in the 20th century in Israel, at least, the Note of Yehuda is completely obsolete. It just, right, you just can't use that standard anymore. And you notice that here again, he has absolutely no evidence. Because the Note of Yehuda correctly set it up that this is not an issue which is resolvable on the basis of textual evidence one way or the other. It's a policy question that has to be inflected by Jewish values. And the challenge is that the way in which those values play out changes over time. So this issue is still ongoing. You can find responsa that are straight Note of Yehuda, and that say, you know what, the issue is, if there's a dead body in front of us, you find that stretch it a little bit forward, maybe there has to be a dead body in the same, maybe there has to be a patient of the same, with the same disease in the same hospital, maybe there's a patient of the same disease with an ambulance range, right? People who try and maintain the Note of Yehuda standard, but as much as they can, because they think the consequences are still unbearable. And then you have people who take Rabbi Weinberg all the way and say that, no, actually, let's take the Note of Yehuda standard literally, not in terms of the balance he was trying to accomplish. And literally, there always is a sick, right? The knowledge almost always benefits the patient directly in front of us. But taking that becomes really hard because really where autopsies are most key are in cases where there's one case of a disease that is known to be contagious and you have to know whether it's been, right? You have to know whether there will be other cases and things like that. So you'll see that the Rabbanut HaRashit in Israel, or the Sitz Eliezer, has a list of like 13 specific cases with types of circumstances which would allow autopsies, like contagious diseases or genetic diseases or death of unknown causes or criminal cases where the cause of death has to be proven and things like that. What I want to leave you with, though, is not a position on the specific issue, which I think is still very, very much and legitimately debated. What I want you to leave you with is a sense of how the halakha developed and how different people can approach issues in different ways, and really, to some extent, the difference between good poskim and great poskim is their capacity to understand the different frames in which the issue can be set. So everyone before the Note of Yehuda saw it as a narrow question of law. The Note of Yehuda saw it as an enormous policy question which addressed both practical and moral considerations. And then Ray Weinberg, as the same person, said, look, this is a different question depending which way you ask me. If you ask me as a private party dealing with a specific case, I would answer one way. But if you ask me as a national posig, I would have to answer differently, and then question that is worth asking is Rabbi Weinberg, is this an act great of Rabbi Weinberg that he can do both? Or is it a failure that he answers privately in a way that wouldn't be sustainable if everyone gave the same answer? I think those are great questions, and I think it's time. No, we actually have 10 minutes left, right? So I was being hyper efficient. So I actually have 10 minutes for questions, so why don't we take questions for the last bit. Yes, Ben.
So if we take this expanded definition of Lepanenu as this creation, maybe why we should, then we have this whole problem that you alluded to earlier. Does that mean that, you know, research institutions, drug, pharmaceutical companies, does that mean that they're chayev, if it's really pikuach nefesh now, does that mean that they're chayev to never let the wheels stop turning and to never let the conveyor belt stop, or do we get out of that some other way?
So I think that the way that Rabbi Weinberg tried to expand it was not by, he accepted the claim that you can't extend it that far, but he said is that now we meet the immediate standard. Right now, every autopsy, there is a patient somewhere. So we can claim that realistically we now meet the Note of Yehuda standard.
What I'm saying is any laboratory that's doing cancer research, there's a patient somewhere that's going to benefit from their results.
Right, so I think that's a fair point. I think that's a fair point. I think that you're right, that Weinberg doesn't give a good enough formulation. All right. And I think that that what he essentially says is, and this is the way I would frame it, the Noda Behuda met a specific historical halakhic situation with a formulation that, while it's difficult to figure out exactly what the Feinu means, but it was a good legal formulation in that it succeeded in balancing the values. Reality has blown up his formulation. Right, in a way that it doesn't make sense anymore to say that it matters whether the patient is in the next room or 5 minutes, right, or 10 minutes drive away. But we haven't come up with a replacement formulation. So that would be, right, you know, that's a real challenge logically, right? It's our job. It might be that if you asked me the question, I would say, what we really need is to do what the Noda Behuda did, which is to come up with a new formulation that balances the issue without any necessary relationship to the Noda Behuda's formulation. And Rabbi Weinberg, you can see, has hints in that, right? He talks about unusual diseases whose cause of death is not immediately known. He's trying to find that, but I think that this is one of the Noda Behuda's truva is one of the great responsa in Jewish history. But I think that the fact that it's great doesn't mean that it's still viable. But that's the right question. Yes, Harvey.
It seems that some of these arguments would carry over into discussions of organ donation.
Sure. It's right. Some people raise similar questions. Can you donate organs if you don't have if there isn't a dedicated donor in advance? Can you donate organs to a bank as opposed to a specific patient? Right. Then some people use an Noda Behuda standard in that case and claim that organ donation is only permitted when it's matched up specifically to a patient and not when you're going to a bank. Of course, that yields really problematic things because then people die because of technicalities because the donor died an hour before the patient reached the list. But in most practical cases, there aren't so many organs where the list goes to zero. So in most practical cases, you can claim that there is a sick person. But as I say, some people go further and claim that under Orthodox Jewish law, in order for there to be a donation, there has to be a specific patient whom the organ is targeted to in advance, and that counts as lefanenu. And the existence of patients somewhere in the world, even though you know they exist, is not useful anymore. Then the Noda Behuda knew perfectly well that there was a statistical certainty that somewhere in the world somebody was suffering from bladder stone. Right, so that's a... yes, Andy.
I'm just wondering, it's a minor point, but it seems like Robert Weinberg seems to indicate that because we've got the communications technology now to put everybody before us, that Noda Behuda was lost some relevancy, but it seemed like the reasoning for the Noda Behuda wasn't that... I mean, I understand his lefanenu to be in terms of the time sequence, not in spatial sequence.
It has to be immediate.
Right. I mean, so even you could postulate that even in the time of the Behuda that indeed they had communications, that lefanenu might apply because, you know, it's before us. This concern seemed to be that the whole political environment, as you pointed out, would allow any research done now for future usage. It's just a minor point, but it seemed like that was a bigger concern.
So we could still run, we could answer Ben's point and claim that research doesn't work because research has too long a lead time. Right, so we can't do that. It's not clear about, maybe we have to figure out medicine factories. So the claim would be that, you know what, we have enough medicine on hand to deal with all the existing patients, and so the possibility that there might be other patients in the future is not, right? We could try to use immediacy as a standard instead of presence, and that might be a way to construct a new framework. That would be problematic for the army autopsies, for example, because the lead time between dissecting, first of all, you need to dissect a whole bunch of patients, and then you need to, right, then you learn stuff about the way in which certain explosives function. And then you have to convey that information to the designers, and they have to redesign the armored personnel carriers. So, it's going to be a long lead time before you find it out. So the question is, does that really satisfy you? We haven't asked the question directly as to what people think is ethically correct or incorrect. And underlying this, since we're acknowledging that we don't have a textual standard, then we have to have a rational or an ethical standard. And the question is, would that work for you, right? Immediacy as a standard, or would you say, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me, because the framework of the way in which medical knowledge is gained is a much more systematic framework than it was then. We're dealing with, you know, when they even wrote this thing, it was John Hunter's chiddush that systematic anatomical study would improve surgery. But it wasn't yet the way in which everything functioned, and now it's the way in which everything functions. Yes, Alan.
So the distinction you make between either ruling narrowly versus ruling based on policy reasons strikes me as particularly relevant this time of year, because I can think of the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa in that way, that Rabbi Zaharia ben Avgust sort of rules on the narrow and ignores, for disastrous ends, the policy issues. So I'm wondering if you have any more thoughts on sort of that and where we are in the Orthodox world today in terms of, you know, which way people are approaching things, and something which is going to be like the Agunah issue. Is that something where people are applying a narrower one with a policy?
So that's an interesting question. And I would be leery about committing myself, because often people who we disagree with take broad policy perspectives, and we would say, yeah, but, you know, you can't make slippery slope arguments about that, right? Really, you should just, right, anything that's technically permitted is okay. So I think certainly you have this phenomenon, but I'm not sure that you can predict which way it goes. I'm not sure you can predict which way it goes at all in terms of that. I should say there's one other thing that I really want to address from my Weinberg, which is part of this, is the Net of Yehuda uses, you know, other people as a basis for stringency. Right? How can we have standards that will horrify the rest of the world in terms of their ethical leniency, because the rest of all other religions are opposed to autopsies and we're going to permit them? Rabbi Weinberg makes a very different argument. Rabbi Weinberg says that the state of Israel can't be seen as morally backwards. And if everyone else permits autopsies, how can we not permit them? And that's an interesting but dangerous argument. But you can see where that comes out now. We'll talk about that perhaps in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, is on the question of organ donations. So because of, in large measure, because of people following halakha, what they see to be Jewish values, Israel has a much lower organ donation rate than Europe. And for that is, at least, you know, kicked out of the consortium of donations in Israel, because the donation to reception rate ratio is not high enough. So Rabbi Weinberg would, you know, in his argument say, well, you know what, maybe that's an argument that halakha must be wrong, because it's creating, you know, because it's making us look terrible morally in the world. And I'm very suspicious of arguments like that. What if the rest of the world is just immoral and we're standing up for the right thing? So I don't know that, you know, I think it's important to recognize that it's legitimate to look at halakha both ways. And that it matters very much whether you get it right or not, which is the right way. But, you know, in any specific case, but the notion that it's always right to look at halakha, you know, in the big picture thing, or it's always right to look at halakha narrowly, that I'm not at all convinced of. I think it's one of the judgment calls that a good posek has to make every time a question comes up. Okay, last question.
There's a, you know, the underlying concept that I make here is taken as a given. What is the source for the prohibition of
So that's a good question. And so the Chacham Sofer and the Binyan Tzion both say that, what, you know, both end up thinking this is inadequate because it doesn't provide a source. And even the people who prohibit it provided sources for the concept, but not sources for the source. So you have people who try and develop it as a conception of theft, people who try and develop it as a conception of illegitimately benefiting from the dead. But I think the simplest argument is that we do have a category, right, that the lead case of kvod habriyot, of human dignity in halakha, is burial. So respect for the dead body is the primary source for all conceptions of human dignity in halakha. So I think it's an easy move to say that cutting up a body is antithetical to the principle embodied in the obligation of burial. Okay, I think it's time to end tomorrow. Thank you very much.